Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Alienable rights, the exclusion of African Americans in a white man's land, 1619 to 2000, is a book written by Professor Barry Sanders of Pitzer College from the Claremont Colleges and Francis D. Adams, an independent scholar living in Los Angeles, California. Sanders and Adams maintain that the drive for equal rights for black people in the United States has never had the support of the majority of Americans. Racial progress has been made in brief historical bursts when a committed militant minority of abolitionists, radical Republicans, and civil rights activists stirred the nation and pressured it into change. In this program, we visit with Dr. Francis D. Adams and begin when I asked him to explain the importance of the trial of James Somerset that took place in England in 1772.
Somerset was a slave to a Virginia slaveholder. He had come with him to England, and he had escaped from his owner in England. And was recovered finally, and the suit developed over whether he was a free man having come to England or whether he remained a slave. Lord Mansfield was the Chief Justice of the King's Bench who oversaw the case and finally reached a decision in relation to it, and he said that Somerset was a free man having set foot in England, that there was no such thing as a slave in England, he said, that the only way you could have slavery in England if there had been positive law, in other words, if there were some sort of legal situation that had created men as slaves, otherwise custom or usage were not sufficient to do that. This meant that about 14,000 black men who were in England were suddenly free. And the question arises, of course, if England had freed its slaves, didn't that control the situation in the colonies? Wouldn't the slaves have been free at that point?
Well, that created a fork in the road that appears not to have been followed, at least in North America.
Yeah, that's perfectly right. What had happened really was that England over the years had given the colonies a good deal of freedom to run things however they wanted to. And in all of its colonies, particularly in North America, the colonies had individually developed their own systems of slavery quite apart from English law. And they had laws that were essentially their own and that were not necessarily consistent from one colony to another.
It's interesting to note that England gave its colonies significant freedom and latitude in making its own rules, but Spain chose not to do that in Central and South America. Why was that?
Well, that's perfectly true. One of the main reasons was the English wanted to didn't want to spend the money it would have cost to control the colonies, and instead they, in the southern colonies at least, where slavery was strong, they relied on enterprising men who were willing to spend their own money to develop the colonies, and they really only retained control over trade and things like war, for example. If the colonies or the or Britain itself had gone to war, they would expect some contribution from the colonies.
The control over trade was somewhat influenced, I would expect, by allowing the colonies to proceed with slavery so that there would be a labor force for the markets that would come and the products that would come from the colonies.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, it relieved the question for Britain of whether they approved of slavery or not, really, because the colonies then were able to do whatever they wanted to do, and the British could say, well, we aren't really responsible for any of that.
So why was the Somerset decision not followed in the colonies?
Well, it wasn't followed in the colonies because it simply didn't fit what existed in the colonies. By 1772, there were hundreds of thousands of slaves throughout the South, and the colonial leaders certainly had no desire to surrender what was the mainstay of the southern economy.
So therefore, from a de facto or functional sense, the Somerset decision had no effect in the colonies and in North America.
Yeah, it really had very little effect. People talked about it, and of course, people around the world and abolitionists or people who believed in abolition in North America pointed to it as an example of what should be done in the colonies, but it had no direct effect really on anyone.
So if we step ahead a number of years and look at the founding fathers, the people who wrote down the words that became the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, what they did at home was somewhat different than what they wrote into the Declaration and the Constitution.
Yeah, it certainly was, particularly among southern members of the founding fathers who were significant slaveholders. I mean, Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, was the primary writer, at least, was a significant slaveholder, as was Washington, Madison, all these men from the South, others whose names we don't know quite so well, but were also members of the Constitutional Convention, men like Randolph and the Pinckneys, that they were all slaveholders at home and maintained large plantations.
Do you think there was a conscious duplicity in their thinking, or was this just the way it was, and from their point of view, God willed it as that?
Yeah, well, no, I don't think it was duplicity at all. I mean, I think they had faith in the life they had constructed for themselves in the New World, and they rationalized it in a number of different ways. One of the things that many of them argued was that the Bible supported slavery, that it was something that existed throughout the world, and that it was a matter of really dealing with an inferior people who were probably better off as slaves than they had been in Africa.
Well, that's one thesis that has been presented on this program, that the Puritan interpretation that people of color were an inferior group actually affected the thinking and the development in terms of a progression toward equality to a greater extent than did the Southern slaveholders' economic interest. Do you find any support for that?
Well, it's certainly true. I think of it as, two great forces that gave the colonists a sense of themselves as a chosen people. On the one hand, in New England, you have Puritanism. With it goes a belief, after all, that the Puritans were a chosen people who were going to purify the church. They had been given this paradisical new continent in which to create a kind of new Jerusalem, and consequently, they were chosen by God. That made them better than everyone else in the world. Therefore, they had a sense of inferiority about many people, and particularly about blacks. Cotton Mather, for example, kept house slaves, and he treated them well, educated them, something that slaveholders in the South wouldn't do. He also writes about, in his household, having to be on guard all the time because it was known by everyone that blacks were naturally thievish. There was a second kind of superiority, too, that probably was stronger in the South, and that was the belief that the men who came to North America were carrying on the tradition of the Anglo-Saxons, and that they themselves were a continuation of the Anglo-Saxon race. And in continental history, the Anglo-Saxons were viewed as a pure race who had never been adulterated by mixing with anyone else. They were a powerful moral race who had lived an almost idyllic life on the continent. And Jefferson, as a matter of fact, when he argued for the right of the colonies to break away from England, he did it on the basis of the fact that they were a continuation of Anglo-Saxons, and as Anglo-Saxons, they weren't governed by laws that the English crown had constructed to govern the Normans who had invaded England. Those were feudal laws that meant that the king essentially owned all the land and granted it to to his vassals. In the case of the Anglo-Saxons, they maintained that the land was theirs by conquest, and that the king never owned the land, that whatever fealty they gave to the king was based on their willingness to do it. And so the Southerners, Jefferson in particular, was a great fan of the Anglo-Saxons, and they believed simply that they were chosen people, again, of a different type, but certainly they were superior to the inferior African-American or black.
When we take a look at the founding documents of the United States, again, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, there's a schism as to the rights of black people. Can you discuss the origin of that?
Well, in the Declaration of Independence, it says that all men are endowed with inalienable rights, which means they have rights that they are given, that they are born with, and that come directly from God, and that all men share those rights. And that was the assertion made in the Declaration of Independence. And it was a fine statement in relation to Great Britain and separating yourself from the English, because what it said was the colonists had a right to break away from England if they wanted to, because freedom was a right that was given to all men by God. By the time you got to the Constitution, freedom was no longer the issue, if you will.
Yet before they got to the Constitution, and even before the Declaration of Independence in 1776, we have the Somerset decision.
Yeah, except the Somerset decision had very little to do with the North American continent. None of the colonies took the Somerset decision so seriously that they acted on it.
Proceeding with the Constitution and the development of the Constitution.
The Constitutional Convention opened with a need to make the government a stronger government. The Articles of Confederation, under which the colonies operated since the time of the Revolution, there was no real central control in it. There was no powerful central government. It allowed each colony an equal vote in any decision that the Confederation was going to reach. And what that meant was that any colony could, in effect, veto any action by the whole 13 colonies or the Confederation. What they found was that they were really unable to function very well internationally. They didn't have a single currency. There were a number of things that made them very difficult for them to simply function as a nation. And as a matter of fact, Alexander Hamilton said just that they would be weak and powerless until the point at which they formed a strong central government. And that was really the point of the Constitutional Convention, to try to bring together the 13 colonies and create a single nation that had a stronger central government.
Let's talk about the development and the effects of the Constitutional Convention on African Americans in the United States. The development of the Constitution ignored the fact that all men are created equal, and in fact didn't even mention women.
Didn't mention slaves, as a matter of fact. Never would use the term in the document. Instead, they called them people serving others, or just referred to them simply as people, but the word slave never appeared in the reason for that, most people think, is that they were really embarrassed in a way about the situation and didn't want to include the existence of slavery in the National Constitution.
I think it also had to do with the economics of the time and the labor force in the South that was a non-industrial area, an agricultural area.
There were no minutes taken at the Constitutional Convention that were at least made public for another 40 years. James Madison kept his own notes of the Constitution, and they have become really the primary document that we used to see what was actually said. And one thing that Madison points out is that very quickly it became clear to the delegates that the major division in the convention was between the slaveholding southern states and the northern states that were free. And much of the attention from that point on at the convention was focused on working out a compromise that would allow the North and the South to form a single union and work together, because the South was very reluctant to enter into a compact with the North because they were afraid Northerners wanted to eliminate slavery. By 1784, New England had already ended slavery, and a movement to get rid of it in the middle states, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, was afoot. South was frightened by this fact.
Even though New England chose to end slavery in many jurisdictions, the concept of superiority that flowed from the Puritan interpretation of the Bible still remained. You agree?
Yeah, oh, of course. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, the point of our book ultimately is that concept of superiority still exists throughout most of the white community in America today.
Well, let's move forward to today and discuss how that concept is seen and applied. Seen from you, a white professor, and seen from a black person.
Well, one of the very interesting things we've found is that we originally, when we wrote the book, we intended it for white people. I mean, that's who we really thought our audience, that our audience would be primarily whites. And what we hoped to do was awaken whites to our own history and suggest that the white community has and continues to have a responsibility in relation to blacks, in relation to the way in which they've been disadvantaged in this society, and should consider doing something about it. What we found among whites is most of them really don't want to hear that message. Most of them resist it pretty strongly. Most African Americans, on the other hand, like the book, and what they say, in effect, is that it lays out a history of what they understand viscerally in their own experience, that indeed the whites still consider blacks inferior and do very little to give them equality in this society.
Notwithstanding the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement 100 years later?
Notwithstanding those things. As a matter of fact, what we say is that there have been three great moments in American history when blacks have made great surges, great advancement. The first was after the Revolutionary War, second was after the Civil War, and the third was associated with the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s. After the Revolutionary War, what happened was there were about 80 to 100,000 free blacks suddenly created, because they were men who had fought with the Continental Army. The prize they had been given for fighting against the British was their freedom. And so you suddenly had this large number of free blacks all over American society. The natural thing to think would be that, well, they were free, and there's a paradigm that says you are free or you are slave, and so these men then, because they were free, would have equal rights with white citizens. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. What they quickly found is they were treated not like white citizens, but as a new class, really, throughout then the early 18th century to the middle of the 18th century. Blacks, for example, could not get passports in this country. They could not travel abroad unless they had recommendation of a white person in power that would help them get an American passport. They were not allowed to work in many civil service positions, for example. They were denied the opportunity to work in postal jobs as postal carriers because it was feared by Southerners that they would carry messages of abolition into the South, and they didn't want that to happen. By the 1740s, a man named Hugh Laguerre, who was the Attorney General of the United States, dealt with this situation in a case that involved the homesteading rights in the territories. That there was a question of whether blacks should be given free land as whites were given in the territories. Aliens were excluded from this right. They had no right to free land in the territories, but whites did. What Laguerre finally said was that blacks were not aliens. They had been here for a long time, and so they did have homesteading rights. But in order to give them the homesteading rights, he didn't say they had the same rights as white citizens. What he said was they were a third category, and he called that category denizens. They were denizens of the land, meaning they had inhabited here for a long period of time, but they were not citizens. And that indeed was pretty much the judgment that stood up until the time of Dred Scott. And what that said, Dred Scott said the same thing, that blacks had no legal rights in U.S. courts because they were not citizens. Point being, really, there was this great surge after the Civil War in which a number of blacks were freed. They were not given the rights of white citizens. They were not free men in this country. There were laws that limited them in every direction in which they turned.
Well, let's move to the present time, 2005.
African Americans have made progress. In too many cases, though, it's reflected by the progress of a small group of people who have been concentrated in entertainment and athletics. Those African Americans certainly have done well. But what we're concerned about is the failure of the white community to address the issue of the bulk of African Americans, particularly those who are stuck in ghetto situations. What you have to remember when you think about African Americans is that of all the different groups that have come to the United States one way or another, all of the other groups have come with a sense of hope and a sense that they could better themselves economically and that they could make a better life for themselves. Blacks, on the other hand, came here in chains without hope, and what we have found at every point at which they've seem to have a moment of hope, those three instances that we were talking about a moment ago, it's taken away by the white community very quickly. That hope is taken from them, and they're stuck with the same situation. And what I believe, this country, we think of a place like South Africa, had a formal reconciliation process that it put in place. The U.S., we had a reconciliation process after the Civil War, but it was reconciliation between Southern and Northern whites, ultimately. And we never really created a similar reconciliation with blacks. Blacks have always asked for three things at each of these three moments in history, and those are education, land, and the right to vote. Again and again, they've simply been denied those things, and though I doubt if most people realize it, but in this country currently, there's something like 7 million African-American children living in extreme poverty. That means not poverty, not that you're poor, but it means that a family of three has less than $7,000 a year to live on. I regard it as simply a travesty that we allow citizens of our country, people who are protected or supposedly protected by a constitution that guarantees equal rights to all citizens, that we allow people to be living in a situation like that.
How do you see the change being fomented?
You know, we began this book when the Clinton administration was in power, and race, it seemed, was moving to the forefront as an issue that we were perhaps going to face. So I think Clinton himself and his administration were much more aware of it than the current administration we have. It's been, frankly, a disappointment to us to see the reaction of the Bush people to the issue of race. I don't think anything is forever, and I don't think the current administration will be there forever, and I would hope ultimately the nation as a country, as a government, would take seriously its obligation to provide equality to all its citizens.
How would you articulate the way that could be done?
What I think has to be done, really, is returned something like the 1960s and a government program that was akin to the movement created then, and the things that were put in place by the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and by the Voter Registration Act the following year. In 64, at Howard University, Lyndon Johnson spoke, and he said that if you take a man to the start of a race who's been in chains for 200 years, and you remove the chains, and then you say to him, well, now you're able to compete equally with everyone else, Johnson said, you're lying to him if you believe that man is capable of competing with everyone else in that condition. And what you have to provide, in effect, was compensatory programs for a period of time to allow him to reach a degree of equality. Then you have a society in which equality prevails. And what Johnson said following that was, what it's going to take for this to happen is willing hearts on the part of whites in this country. And it seems to me what we haven't had are those willing hearts.
So you're saying that almost two generations later, it's time for the hearts to be willing.
Well, I'm saying that we have to create a situation in whites, in which whites understand their responsibility. Naive people that we were, we hope that a book like ours, if the white community would read the book, they'd be more likely to take up a responsibility which we believe is firmly theirs. I mean, this country, we talk so much about responsibility that we simply, you know, rely on those characteristics which we regard as American and the best examples of what our society can do, and assume our responsibility and do for the other citizens in this society what we expect for ourselves.
Francis Adams, co-author with Professor Barry Sanders of Alienable Rights, The Exclusion of African Americans in a White Man's Land, 1619 to 2000. I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Francis D. Adams is the co-author, along with Professor Barry Sanders, of Alienable Rights, The Exclusion of African Americans in a White Man's Land, 1619 to 2000. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.